Welcome back to Durker and Haught on Baseball, where I'll talk old school baseball with former Astros pitcher, broadcaster, and manager, Larry Durker.
Welcome back to Durker and Haught on Baseball. And Larry, today we're going to talk about the passing of a seven-year teammate of yours, Joe Morgan. You saw him early on, came up at virtually the same time. What were your impressions of him during the years he was your teammate compared to the player he became later? How was his development? I know you've had some thoughts on his defense got better and other things. Take me back to the early days with Morgan and your impressions of him.
Well, in the early days, he was a terrific player, but certainly not an all-star or MVP type player. And I think it's just because it took him a little while to really hone his talent and make the most of it offensively. He always had a good eye. He always walked a lot. Early in his career with Houston, he hit 260 or 70 most of the time. And he was still quite a useful player because once he got on base, he could steal bases. And he had the rare combination of having a good eye and walking a lot and enough speed to make that walk into a double fairly often, and he had the power to hit the ball out of the ballpark. So he was, once he got to the Reds, I didn't know how to get him out. I didn't want to walk him because I didn't hold runners real well, but I didn't want to throw the ball over the middle of the plate because he might hit it out of the ballpark. And I'm not even sure how I ended up doing it. I looked at it one time, and I think he hit about 370 against me, but I don't think I walked him that much. I was probably just trying to throw everything low and away so he would hopefully hit the ball on the ground and make it out. But he really just got better and better and better. And the only tool he didn't have was a good arm. And he didn't have a good arm when he was in Houston. He didn't have a good arm when he was with the Reds. He didn't even have that much when he came back to the Astros and the other teams. But he did a nice job of dealing with that, and most of that was because of positioning. He had trouble if he had to go to his right and catch a ground ball and stop and set and throw the ball to first base. So he started cheating over more toward second base and kind of positioning his body more toward the on-deck circle along the right side. So he wasn't facing straight to the batter, but that he could just sprint to his left and get balls in the hole with his speed, and he could get around those balls that were coming up the middle, so we didn't have to try to stop his momentum and plant and throw. He could get the ball facing more towards first base and get a little more on the throw. So he ended up winning Gold Gloves, and I would say the Gold Gloves were from sheer determination, that he wasn't going to let any part of his game be less than what it could possibly be. To tell you the truth, Jim, that carried over into his personal life. He was very meticulous about the way he approached himself as a player and a person in the world at large. An example of that was the way he dressed impeccably, the way he would give himself a little haircut all the time so that there was a clean line in front of his head and then down towards his sideburns. His car was always waxed and shiny and perfectly clean. He was just one of those special people that you would like to see more of in this world. Unfortunately, you don't. But I think everybody that spent time with him early in his career, like I did, witnessed the great player that he would become on his way to doing that. And I don't think anybody is surprised that he ended up being a Hall of Fame player. It wasn't all perfect natural ability because he did have that one tool that was missing. And he just, second base is the best place to be if you don't have a very good arm. Right. And he made the most of it.
I have heard and read, and he has related also how Nellie Fox worked with him and his when they were both still active players, and even after that.
He did. Nellie was a coach with us for a year or two at the beginning of my career, and he worked with Joe a lot. Nellie was a second baseman, I think, ended up in the Hall of Fame. Different kind of hitter because he didn't have power. But he worked with Joe making a double play, worked with him on positioning and on strategy, what to do when and where to play. And he also worked with him on bunting. And that's what drove me nuts about pitching to the Red Machine. It wasn't Benton Perez. It was Morgan and Rose, Dreesen and Griffey. It was all of the left-handed hitters that could beat you with big ball, and they could beat you with little ball, too. They would chop the ball or bump, you know, bunt, and just do those little things that are probably, from a pitcher's standpoint, that are more exasperating than a guy hitting a home run.
If you had been manager and Morgan was still an active player in his prime, where would you have hit him in the order?
I would let off with him.
Okay.
I did that myself with Craig Biggio, and at first he was resisting because he liked to hit second.
Okay.
And so back then, before the analytics, I already knew what a strong leadoff hitter would do for a lineup. I knew that personally as a pitcher. You know, if it was Maury Wills, it's no big deal. You know, he didn't walk that often, and you could throw the ball down the middle because he couldn't hit a home run. So he didn't get hardly any RBIs. But if you went to the other base dealer during that era, Lou Brock, he could hit the ball out of the ballpark. And so you had to be a little more careful with him. And obviously, he stole a lot of bases like Wills did, but he was much more dangerous. If you're pitching in a league without a DH, which the National League was until they finally spoiled that now, but anyway, if I'm pitching and I get into trouble and there's guys on base at the end of the batting order, a lot of times, let's say, for example, if it was the Dodgers and Maury Wills was leading off, or it was the Braves and Felix Dion was leading off, I felt like I could pitch the eight-hitter tough if I only had one out. And because then I had the pitcher, and then I had a guy that didn't have any RBI capability. But if I had, if I were pitching with Joe Morgan leading off, or the same way with Ricky Henderson leading off, same way Lou Brock leading off, same way with Felipe Alou, and I had to go after the eight hitter. I couldn't afford to walk him or do anything. I had to pitch him really tough and get the pitcher because I didn't want the lineup to turn over with guys on base and the leadoff hitter who was also a good RBI man. Craig Biggio, of course, fit that same mold, so that's why I let him off. He had a lot of home runs, well over 200 home runs. He was a good RBI hitter. And, you know, it would make you face the eighth inning. Now you don't ever have to do that because there's no strategy left in the game. After they've done away with the pitcher hitting and they've decided that everyone should swing for the fences instead of trying to hit and run or hit to the opposite field or move a runner or bunt, you know, you don't see it. There's no strategy left in baseball other than when to change pitchers.
Right.
So, but back then, you know, I really, even when I was broadcasting before I went down to the dugout, I really appreciated the value of a leadoff hitter that can drive in runs. And so obviously Morgan could drive in runs, and I think they'd like to lead off with Rose most of the time, but Pete wasn't going to steal very many bases, and actually he wasn't going to hit that many home runs either. He would drive in runs because he got so many hits, but he wasn't really a dangerous hitter. So that would be me. If it were Joe Morgan and I were managing, he would lead off.
It's interesting that a couple of points. One is that one of the criticisms of Rose as a player here in Cincinnati was that he did not drive in very many runs despite the number of hits he got. that he would drive in 55 runs a year, maybe. And considering the opportunities, you know, it wasn't all that many, even for a leadoff guy. And yet they had Morgan hitting second behind him a lot of the time, so they would hit and run and do things like that. But
or bunt. You know, people bunted back then. Joe was a pretty good bunter, and I think he I'm positive that if he were around and had followed baseball's trajectory into the era of analytics, that he would understand why it's better, unless you have some kind of Sandy Koufax or a dominating strikeout pitcher. But otherwise, with the average pitcher, the two-hitter, if it's Morgan, should not be bunting.
Right.
And I think he would know that. But back then, he probably accepted that role because that's what went with the two-hitter. And when I was managing, I used a more traditional lineup with a second hitter in the two-hole that could bunt and could move runners and could, you know, handle the bat, didn't strike out very much, and hopefully fast enough to steal a base here and there if the leadoff hitter doesn't get on. So I wasn't looking for anybody with any clout in the two-hole. But now I see where the Angels hit Mike Trout second a lot.
Yeah.
And they
think
the second place in the order is more important than the third, or the third or the first. Myself, I'm still not sure of that. I think if I were managing and I had a guy that was a good on-base hitter with a little bit of speed, I'd be tempted to put him in a two-hole.
Right. And there was, with Morgan, there was talk that he really became an MVP-type player when the Reds dropped him to third in the order. And then he started driving in all kinds of runs in addition to everything else. He'd lead the league in walks. He'd steal 60 bases a year. But he started driving in 110, 120 runs a year.
So, and part of that was Pete, because Pete got on base a lot. He got on base mostly because he hit for average. I think he drew some walks too. Obviously, if you have this mental image I have of him at the plate, if the ball goes by and it's anywhere near the strike zone, and he doesn't swing, his head goes straight back to the umpire.
Right.
Almost like he's challenging him to call a strike on him.
Yeah, he went from driving in maybe 65, 70 runs a year in the two-hole to all of a sudden in 75 they drop him to three and they put Griffey at two.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, you know, 132 walks and 110 runs driven in, and just one of my lasting memories of Morgan, at least as a Red, is if it was the seventh inning or later and he came up and it was a close game, you just had this feeling he could get a walk anytime he wanted, that he would intimidate whatever else he had to do, that he could get on base and he was going to steal second. Everybody in the park knew it, and yet he would still do it.
Yeah. Well,
could you have seen him? There was an awful lot of talk after he got through playing about him as a manager because he was so intelligent and all that, but he never took the bait. He never did seriously consider managing. Could you have seen him as a manager, and would he have been successful?
Well, he may have had been a little too intense for maybe to manage teams the way they're situated now, because I don't think he would tolerate less than 100%, and a lot of players just aren't capable of giving you 100%. So in that sense, he may have had a difficulty, but in the sense of understanding the game, the strategy, where a guy should hit in the batting order, even the pitching, I think he would have been excellent. So the only reason I think that he would have been less than that would be, well, one, the obvious thing, if his team didn't have any talent. Nobody can manage a team that doesn't have enough talent to win a championship. But if he had talent, he would do well, unless he ran into that trouble you get into sometimes in the locker room where guys start questioning your judgment, and there's, you know, you're not going to know it when you're managing because you're in your office or you're wherever you are. It's other places where you're not around. They start to second guess and that sort of thing if you're not winning. And so, you know, he may have had a little bit of trouble being tolerating, I guess, guys who are didn't have the kind of focus, intensity, and desire that he had.
Where would you place Morgan among great second basemen?
Well, I come to might surprise you with that. The best second baseman that I witnessed is Robbie Alomar.
Okay.
I don't think he's quite the hitter, but he certainly didn't have any problems with it, with a bat as well, but he was really a gifted fielder. Ryan Sandberg was great. He caught everything. He didn't ever bobble the ball. He had a really good arm. I don't think he covered as much ground as Robbie. I don't think he had a better arm. Joe is probably a step beyond those two guys, and Craig Biggio too, but you have to consider their place in the batting order. So Alomar was usually at the top of the lineup, and he played on some really good teams with a lot of good hitters in front and behind him. So that helped. Sandberg, not so much, in terms of the hitters all around him, and certainly Biggio, not so much. It's very hard for me to compare and contrast. I have to go back to the second book I read and look at all the second basemen I considered. I know I'm probably leaving somebody out, Bobby Gritz. I never saw him play very much, so I don't know. And obviously there were players from the early years of the game that were just, you know, their numbers are unbelievable, and the anecdotal evidence is the same way.
That's it for this episode of Durker and Hot on Baseball. Check us out on Facebook or at hotcorner.com.